Latte for Keenan?
That's me.
Hey, you're...
Yeah.
Buying a car online on AutoTrader?
Really? But unlike other sites, you can start online, test drive with a local dealer, then finish online or at the dealership.
Cool. Enjoy.
Buy your car online on AutoTrader. Really.
Welcome to another episode of Dreamers, Drivers, and Doers. I'm Steve Millar at the Greater Akron Chamber, and in this podcast, we feature what's happening in Greater Akron, the people, the events, the opportunities that are shaping our region. Today, I'm bringing you another special episode as part of our mini-series from the inaugural Business Growth Symposium held in mid-June, focused on second-stage owners, founders, presidents, and CEOs. Just talking about growth, talking about how to take a company from where it is to where they want to go. We did a lot of learning, collaboration, and connection that day, all around, again, the real work of growing and scaling businesses, which is key to our success here in the region. This session is really all about what it means to build a business to grow or build a business to sell. As a business owner, whether you plan to sell your business or not, the same principles apply. Companies with strong systems, clear structure, scalable operations are better positioned to create value over time. And we're going to talk about a little bit about that, about how these owners, founders, presidents think about building that infrastructure in their business to create value and opportunity for themselves, for their organizations. The panel is moderated by Dan Hampu, who's the CEO of the Burton D. Morgan Foundation, a foundation in our community focused on really driving success for entrepreneurs, especially growing companies. Dan is also a former founder and small business owner, successful entrepreneur himself. So he brings a really unique perspective for this panel. Fellow panelists, Anna Luskow, partner at Lewis Brisbois, Brad Martin, founder of Focus CFO, and John Lubinsky, a former entrepreneur, again, successfully had settled business, but now a commercial real estate broker and a VP of Hanna Real Estate and Hanna Business Advisors. They're going to talk about how companies can strengthen their foundation to support that long-term growth, prepare for a future exit from operations to finance, leadership structure, and strategic positioning. So all the pieces that you need in place to really be able to either grow and build that business or exit from the business, depending on what your goals are. It's really a practical conversation about building a business that's stronger, more resilient, and more attractive to investors, buyers, or the next stage of growth. So I hope you enjoy this. Take a listen and enjoy your day. Thanks.
My name's Dan Hampu. I'm with the Burton D. Morgan Foundation. I'll let each of our esteemed panelists share a little bit more about themselves just really quickly, and I'd ask them to also share, why are you guys on this panel other than Bryn or Steve or someone else that, hey, you'd be really good for this.
Hi, my name is Anna Luskow, and I'm a partner at Lewis Brisbois, Bisgard & Smith. We're a national law firm, but we have an office here in Akron, and I practice mergers and acquisitions law and just general corporate law. So that's why I'm here, to give the perspective of what sellers are looking for, what buyers are looking for, investment bankers and all those players in mergers and acquisitions, and just kind of how you can prepare your business for growth or for sale.
My name is John Lubinsky. I'm currently with Hanna Commercial Real Estate. I'm an entrepreneur. I bootstrapped a fire protection company in 1999 and sold it to a private equity firm in 2018. I grew it from one employee to 65 and four branch offices throughout the Midwest. And I'm here to impart some of that experience and wisdom if possible. So,
my name is Brad Martin. I'm with a company called Focus CFO. I started the company in 2001. The first 18 years of my career were in corporate finance, and then had this idea about taking seasoned executives and making available to smaller businesses. And today they call that fractional. So we were doing it before the word kind of became in vogue, but really appreciate the chance to be here. I think I'm here for two reasons. One, I started a company from scratch, and the original plan was going to be me and three people. And today we sit and we're in 18 states, I think, and we have 300 people. And we're probably the largest fractional CFO group in the country, although that doesn't really matter. But we love Northeast Ohio. We've been here for a long time. So I have the perspective of the person that started a business and has grown. And also, is what we do as fractional CFOs, we work with business owners every day doing this. So we have just lots and lots of experience in counseling with people and talking to people and and helping them.
Thanks, you guys. And I'll just share just a little bit about Morgan Foundation and myself as well. But Morgan Foundation's in Hudson. Serial entrepreneur Bert Morgan built and sold multiple companies. And now we have $200 million to distribute into the community in various portions each year to advance entrepreneurship in the free enterprise system. So we care a lot, Bert cared a lot about growing enterprise value of companies, ultimately, which landed him in some sales. Personally, I was involved with a company before joining the Morgan Foundation called Fontis Blue, which was a software for optimizing water and wastewater treatment operations. And that company sold in June of 2020, so June of last year, so relatively recently. So also a part of this journey being a member of the founding team of that organization. So a lot of this is going to be focused on how do we develop and what does it mean to develop enterprise value? So I'm going to kick off there. If our group wouldn't mind sharing in each of your own minds, what does it mean to build enterprise value?
Sure. So from my perspective, I'm seeing it from the due diligence perspective when someone is going to sell their company. And so we're looking at all categories of the business. We're looking at employment, management, financial, tax, corporate governance. So all of those areas have value. It's not just about what your EBITDA is. It's not just about, you know, what your revenue is. It's all aspects of your business. So what I see the businesses that have the easiest time selling are the most efficient and well run. They have good corporate records. They had a succession plan in place. They have their stock ledger is up to date. You wouldn't imagine how many companies don't actually have a record of who owns the shares in their company, which is very important when you're doing a stock sale. So if I can stress one thing today, it's, you know, if you own your own business, go look at the records and make sure that you have that well documented. But it's also just knowing your company and knowing also where the weaknesses are and knowing how you can address those. So from my perspective, enterprise value is being strong in all categories, but also knowing that if you're stronger in one category, you know, not every issue is going to make or break a deal, but getting in touch with lawyers early on and investment bankers to look at the health of your company and see where your weaknesses are and having a plan to address them and understand, you know, what the impact is going to have on your company.
It may sound a little bit too keep it simple, stupid, but generally speaking, I kind of look at it as, you know, you created a company that somebody could run without you. And it's at its very basic core, you know, if somebody sees value in what you're producing, whether it's a service or a product, but how does that business run without you in it? And what type of systems and leadership team do you have in place for that to continue without your day-to-day operations?
It's really interesting when people talk about enterprise value. And again, enterprise value is really what a business is worth. So people think about enterprise value really from two perspectives. One is from the owner's perspective. So most owners have or think they have some idea about what their business is worth. A lot of times that number is way up here. From the buyer's perspective, a lot of buyers are very, very sophisticated about how they do valuation. And a lot of it is math. And so you'll hear, you've heard these before, but you'll hear EBITDA tossed around a lot, earnings before interest, taxes, depreciation, amortization. It's similar to net income, but it doesn't have some non-cash things like depreciation and amortization in it. And then you'll hear something called a multiple. And so the math becomes, what's my EBITDA? And then what's the multiple? And look, I'm so tired of hearing people talk about EBITDA. I mean, it's everywhere. I think the real opportunity that we have as business owners, if we're trying to maximize the business, is to focus on the two drivers of enterprise value, which is one, how do I get my EBITDA up? How do I increase? And just think of that as profitability. How do I get that up? But probably more important than that, how do I get the multiple up? Because if I have a business that does $1 million of EBITDA and it's valued at a one multiple, it's worth $1 million. If I have a business that does $500,000 of EBITDA and it has a 10 multiple on it, its value is much higher. Okay. So think about it from that standpoint. And so a lot of what we're going to talk about today is, yeah, you'll hear EBITDA a lot, but a lot of the things that we're going to talk about relate to the multiple. And that's the part that people really don't understand. So hopefully as we go through it, some of that will jump out at you.
So, Brandon, I'll keep it with you. As you think about this question, does it start when you're like, okay, I'm going to market, I'm going to try and sell my business, or when is it appropriate? And could you maybe even speak to situations where if you have experience on like family businesses versus lifestyle businesses versus already pre-existing growth-oriented businesses?
Yeah, it's a great question. So look, some of people in the room are solo entrepreneurs. You started your business, you bootstrapped your business. That's what I did. I mean, I started it by getting all my personal assets and convincing my wife that it was a good thing to do. And we kind of went all in on the business. Other people have done it differently. Other people go out and raise capital. So sometimes they call those institutional investors, or you might hear the word angel investor, or tech things might be venture capital. So I think for the solo, look, when I started, I could care less about enterprise value. I was a solo guy just trying to figure something out, and all I cared about was cash flow. That's all I cared about was cash flow. Now, as the business grew and it started to have scalability, then certainly the concept of enterprise value came into it. But for me as a solo person, it was not the primary thing I was focusing on in day one. It became something I strive towards later. But again, if you're on the other end of the spectrum where your capital is coming from other people putting their money in looking for a return, you need to be thinking about enterprise value on day one, because they're thinking about enterprise value because there was a valuation on the business when they put money in and they want to get a return on their investment. And it's really, really important. But look, over time, I think we all touch this at different things. And look, there's nothing wrong with having a lifestyle business. There's nothing wrong with that. But if you do want to have plans to sell your business and grow it and scale it, you have to begin thinking about enterprise value and what it's going to be worth. Because you need to make sure there's not a gap between your expectation for what it's worth and what a buyer is actually going to pay for it, because that'll be a very frustrating process if you don't understand it.
Yeah, very similarly, I cashed in my 401k and pushed all my chips in the middle of the table, so to speak. So enterprise value didn't even know what the word meant, to be quite honest with you, for the first 3 or 4 years. And that slowly started to change as I grew the company and worked on, you know, there's a lot of buzzwords, but as I focused on working on the company and not in it, that started to become more an important factor for me as I decided, you know, what my exit strategy was it going to be my children, or did I want to sell to a local competition, or was, you know, what did I want to do? And I decided relatively early that I did not want to pass it along to my kids, not for any good reason other than I didn't want to put them in that position and have them have that decision to make and feel pressure to do something like that when maybe that's not in their best interest and maybe that's not the best path for them. I ended up deciding to sell to my private equity, but my goal was to be able to invest in my children's goals from a small business perspective after the fact. So,
so I was going to just share a little bit of my perspective because I think it's also augments this. The company that I was involved with, we didn't set out from the beginning to look for a sale, but I know that when I got involved, there was a combination of sweat equity and some real cash on the line. And I remember conversations with my wife about like, I need you to be comfortable, honey, in this frame of mind that we're lighting this money on fire in the backyard. I hope it returns. And here is what I think the enterprise value of this company will need to be in order to have a multiple to eventually sell for the right return, if that were to happen. But from like a dynamic with my spouse, I was like, I need you to be on board with this. Like, I want this to be a good, high quality return. But at the same time, I don't want there to be the stress or as much stress relating to the dollars. But Anna, do you want to provide any perspective?
Yeah, I certainly don't think it hurts from the beginning to be thinking about it, even if your actions don't necessarily reflect that, because you can't always plan for the future. I mean, you might plan, I'm going to piggyback on what John said, to pass your business on to your kids and think that they're going to love that and they're going to want that. And I've seen it happen, unfortunately, where it's like a 30 or 40 year old business. They inherited it from their parents. They think their kids are going to take over it and their kids don't want to. And they've been running it as a small family owned business that no one, it's going to take a lot of work to be able to sell it. And so their options are very limited and they end up having to just liquidate the assets and they're not getting anything for the company that they built, the goodwill that they put into the company. So I think always having it as part of the conversation is smart. And I think good succession planning comes into that and having the right documentation, like whether you're a corporation, it's a shareholder agreement, or an LLC and it's an operating agreement. Make sure that you're thinking about all of your options, what your shareholders can do with their shares, whether they're restricted from transferring them or not. And, you know, can family members inherit shares, or does the company automatically have to redeem them? Kind of setting yourself up for all of those possibilities that you may not want to think about now, but that you have to plan for in the event that they happen.
Thanks. So we're going to continue on with this. I've heard the speakers earlier this morning talked about the importance of teams, the reference to managing systems. And so my question now to the panel is, when you think of companies or through your experience that were set up for and well positioned for growth, what were some things that came to be? And if you want to hit on any of those things that previous speakers have mentioned and go a little bit in depth with some of the stuff that you've each experienced, that'd be great.
I'll jump in real quick. But I was in a service-based business. So I wanted to automate and make sure that from a customer's perspective, that I was exceeding every expectation. So I reverse engineered all of our interaction with customers, and I found that to be very helpful, not only from a business profitability perspective, but also from a growth and a success perspective, because I acted as if I was one of my customers on every point of sale and every touch point. So, and I don't know that that was necessarily created a process, but I always searched and was constantly looking for software and other technology to utilize in my business to streamline and make everything easier and more, and allowed all of my employees to focus on what we did well, which was fire protection and dealing with customer issues. So,
I've got two different perspectives. I've got the perspective of the entrepreneur, and I've got the perspective of the financial person. So, as an entrepreneur, like in our business, I think the thing that I was able to do early on was very similarly, how do we get into repeatable processes that could scale? And again, just think about your business and if you can figure out what the, you know, we talk about our business like it's a cellular model. So it's like we find one thing that works and then we repeat it over and over and over and over. And so the trick is to figure out the economics and the triggers of that one unit thing that you're trying to scale. So if you're construction, it might be how you do projects. If it's manufacturing, it's how you do manufacturing. If it's a service business, it's how you're selling time. How do you figure that out, and how do you replicate it and make it repeatable so that it can scale? And too many business owners make the business completely dependent upon them. That is the number one detractor of business value, is how much an enterprise value is, how dependent is the business on the business owner. We'll probably get into that later. If I put my finance hat on, the number one driver of enterprise value is predictable, repeatable cash flow. You can make a list of 100 things. That's number one at the top. Because what the buyer is trying to do is the buyer is trying to predict whether they're going to get a return on their investment or not. And the return on investment is based around cash flow. So again, a lot of times when people run businesses, they run businesses with accounting reports. Accounting reports are historical. They're the past. How do you have the information that tells you how you did today? This is a scorecard. How you're doing today, how you're doing tomorrow, and then what is your cash flow going to look like in the future? That's really what a buyer is looking for, is do you understand that and does it make sense to them, and how do they put a valuation on it? So I would go back to, how do you create scalability? How do you lessen owner dependence? And how do you create predictable, repeatable cash flow in your business?
Yeah, and I'll piggyback on that. A lot of times in a sale, depending on the size of your business, the buyer might only be looking at like the top 10 customers and really focused on that. So having that reoccurring revenue is really important. And I guess I'll kind of segue into our next topic, which is about, you know, founder-centric businesses. But obviously, like, if you are selling your company, you're not going to be running it. Now, you might end up in some capacity as a consultant for the purchaser, which, you know, depending on who you are, that might be something that you want. But when businesses are too founder focused, it is hard to accomplish that transition. And, you know, something that you have to look at is delegating and having the right management team in place and not being afraid to let go of the reins a little bit, even if you built the company yourself from the ground up. If you want it to be scalable, you will at some point have to let go of some of the control.
And I teed this up really nicely, but our next one is on the founder or the leadership dynamic and the kind of a trap that comes with, especially if you're the founder. But I'm gonna plug Brad's book, even though I haven't even finished it. He mentioned the accounting looks backward and finance looks forward and is much more strategic. Brad does have a good book called The Never Climb Alone. It's a business fable about the relationship that you can establish. And you heard about EOS and Traction and other books. It's a book that really hits on some of those things that allow for systems and processes to help really advance your business moving forward. This is a little bit about the founder or the leader trap. And so my question to the group is, what are some of the signs that business owners might recognize that they are stuck, they're a bottleneck, and how can they potentially think about handing off or delegating, as you've mentioned, some of these really important things, but in order to grow, they have to be handed off.
Yeah, I would say if something were to happen to you, or if you were away, could your business run itself? Would you have the right people in place to run it for you? Do you trust people enough at your organization to be able to take over for you if, you know, something happened or if you were ill? And just really honestly doing an assessment, like, what am I still holding on to? What aspect of the business do I not need to be holding on to? Because from my perspective in M&A is when we have businesses that are so founder dependent, the sale process can be really grueling. The due diligence process, I think, surprises a lot of people, like what the buyer, how deep the buyer is going to be going into your books and records. And when the founder can't delegate some of the interactions, you know, with the attorneys to other people in the organization, if they don't trust people enough, they're going to be running their company and working a second job at responding to all these due diligence requests. And it can take months. I've seen it take up to a year. And there's deal fatigue is real. So if you are thinking about growing your business for the purpose of selling it, that's one incentive to start delegating so that when that time comes, it's not just you who is, everyone is looking to for the answers to all these really, really nitpicky questions.
I did a quick exercise when I, midway through one of my, or as I was growing my business, I had a pad of paper next to my phone, and I wrote down everything that I did all day for about a week. And I looked at that list after that week and drilled down and figured out all of the things that I didn't like doing, that I didn't enjoy, but I ended up doing on a weekly basis. And I hired and delegated those things out. And then my eventual goal, and this sounds kind of counterintuitive, but I tried to hire myself out of a job every time I was growing, and eventually that worked. So,
gosh, I mean, this is really hard. I mean, if you're one of the ones that stood, this is really hard because, look, in the beginning, we do everything. We do everything in the business. And I mean, we'll be 25 years old in the fall in September. So for the first 17 years, our business was completely dependent upon me. I mean, if I got hit by a bus, the business would have gone down. And we did start to run EOS, and I'm not going to do the EOS commercial, but I'm probably the biggest advocate of EOS in the world. I mean, it's life-changing. What it did is it just forced me into a place where I had to change, where I had to decide if I wanted to change. And so I think, I'm always reminded, there's a story about, and again, a lot of it just depends on where you are in the cycle and what you actually want to do with your business. But, and at some point, whether we want to sell it or not, we may be forced to sell it. So we always have to start thinking about this stuff. But I'm just reminded of a story about a business buyer that was sitting down with two business owners. And he sat down with one and said, "Tell me about the big sale that you guys got, the biggest sale you guys got last year." And he went down the talk track of, "Yeah, it was a relationship that I've had for so many years, and I pursued it, and I was involved in the negotiations, and I brought this thing over the finish line, and it was a, you know, whatever, huge contract for us." The buyer sits down with another business owner and says, "Tell me about the biggest contract that you guys brought in." And he says, "I don't know. My team brought it in." So guess which one got the higher valuation? And again, you just have to think about it from, just put yourself in the place of somebody buying a business. And I've bought businesses too. You're going to put money into a business, and what's going to walk out the door? You know, is that business going to continue, or is the owner's relationships all going to walk out the door? Was the owner involved in all the decisions, or is there a leadership team? Are there processes? Are there things documented? Are the legal records right? Are the financial stuff? We could talk about financial stuff all day long. I mean, it's a massive detractor for business value. But, you know, I can tell another story about a guy who's running a business and it's doing $500,000 worth of profit. And the buyer says, "Well, who does your sales?" And he says, "Well, I do sales." "Well, who runs production?" "Well, I've got somebody in the shop, but I'm back there all the time." "Well, who watches the money?" "Well, I've got an office manager, Sally, but I'm really involved." Let me get this straight. So if I buy your company, I have to hire somebody to run sales. I have to hire somebody to run production. I have to hire somebody to do the financial stuff. So now all of a sudden, instead of the business having $500,000 of profit, it has no profit. Okay. And this is just classic examples of owner dependence, but in the beginning. We are doing everything. We have to decide how we're going to make the shift, because if you make the shift and get on the other side of it, it's transformational. And your multiple goes from 1 to 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. Massive.
One other consideration to have is if you are going to sell your company, a lot of your customer contracts are, if you're doing an asset sale, they might have an assignment provision in them, and you might have to get the consent of the customer to transfer the contract to the new buyer. And if the relationship is 100% dependent on you and it's you that they're contracting with, not the company, they might not consent to that assignment, and you can lose some of your biggest customers, which could make the purchase price be reduced because the buyer is dependent on those relationships. So you want to make sure that the customer is entering into a contract with your company, the brand of your company, not just you as the founder.
I was at another conference regarding different types of succession planning, and I love this quote because it was called the business owner's paradox, and it said, the more valuable your enterprise becomes, more valuable the less valuable you are. I was like, oh, that's actually really, really truthful. So I kind of use that as a North Star whenever I've been working with entrepreneurs in different capacities. We mentioned some sales related activities and how to preserve that in contracts. Are there any other things as you guys think about developing enterprise value that could really scale it and prepare somebody if they were to eventually look to sell?
Me too. I mean, let me just go back to the financials part again, partially because it's what we do, but partially because as a business owner and as somebody who's involved in transactions, one of my really good friends is a business broker, and he specializes in working with businesses that have EBITDA of under $1 million. And I see him, he's in my Vistage group. I see him all the time. And every time I see him, he rattles off 6 or 7 deals that fell apart because the business didn't have good financials. And they basically push a mess of financials to the table and expect somebody else to figure it out. And again, having really tight, look, and there's accounting. I always talk about past, present, future. So the accounting is the past. The accounting has to work. Okay, your books has to be closed every 15 days after the end of the month. They have to be closed. Your accounting has to be simple. Okay, it has to make sense to people. That has to work. In a lot of areas, that's the least important part of this. The scorecard, what's going on today? How much money did I make yesterday? What's my profitability? What's my profitability by pick whatever it is, by product, by service line? What's my margin on every single thing I do? You have to know that. And then the future is some forward-looking projection. We call it a DNA model. Okay, it gets to the heart of the business, every single aspect of the business. And look, it's never right, but it's directionally close. Okay, and if you've got the right metrics driving it, then it's going to, you know, revenue is not one number. Revenue is 10 things that lead to one number. It's your sales funnel. It's your sales pipeline. Okay. If you've got all of these things in place, when a buyer comes in, this is a massive advantage to you. I mean, now all of a sudden you're choosing between people that you want to sell to because your financial sophistication is so, so strong, as opposed to somebody who's got poor records, poor accounting.
One thing to consider, depending on where you are in this cycle, is, you know, how involved are you in the day to day, and when you go on vacation, what exactly happens, and how much time can you take off from your business, and how well does it run without you involved in every decision? That is what a buyer is looking at when they're looking at your business, and you're just safe to assume that you won't be involved. So just get that up, kind of get that out of your head. At some point, you'll be, you know, moved out or whatever. When I sold my business, I made it clear to all of the buyers that I was not staying on in any capacity, because I, quite frankly, didn't want to work for somebody else in my own company, which sounds odd, but that was very true. So, but just consider that when you, you're trying to take a vacation or something simple like that, think about all of those tasks that you are afraid that won't get done or won't work out well. So,
let me make another comment. The other thing too about sticking around. So, look, we're not trying to sell our business or anything like that, but I've actually told our board that I don't want to be involved in anything going forward. So I've kind of made that transition myself. And so there's a whole leadership team that runs the company. But a lot of times when a buyer comes in, if they can't get their hands around everything and if they perceive risk on something, whether it's customer contracts on the legal side or environmental or people issues, your key people don't have non-competes and non-solicitations. I mean, think about that. I mean, how many of your key employees have non-competes with? So if I buy your company, your top people can actually leave and go to work for a competitor and take all your customers. Now your business value has just gone down to almost nothing. Okay. That gets to the importance of having really, really good legal documents. But if you were to sell a business and the buyer can't get their hands around things, they may say, I'll give you $8 million for your business. But five of it is tied up in what they call an earnout, which means I'm going to pay it over time, over the next 3 to 5 years, based on how the business performs. And you probably have to be involved in that. So, again, a lot of times when you sell your business, you don't want to be involved. But if you don't have things together inside the business, you don't have your act together, in order to get the value, you're going to be forced to. And you're going to go from being somebody who gets to make every single decision to somebody who can't buy a laptop or hire an employee without somebody else approving it. And that's really, really frustrating for a lot of business owners. But a lot of that circles back to the fact that you haven't done the things to de-risk business ahead of time.
Just to piggyback on that, the imagine, if you will, trying to run your business and make decisions. If you sell your business and some portion of the sale is on an earnout, you're tying all of your future payments to somebody else running the company, and you no longer have that control. So it's a very important consideration, I guess, when trying to value what you got for the sale. So
financials are incredibly important, but also, and this might seem really obvious, but being very organized with your books and records, because you're going to end up paying a lot more in legal fees if you haven't been keeping track of anything, really. You know, even employees, like not having like a great employee census, or not knowing which employees you've entered into contracts with, or not being able to locate contracts, not being able to locate fully executed contracts, not even having copies of them. You're going to incur a lot more in legal fees from your own attorneys, from the buyer's attorneys, as they're trying to sort through everything and they're asking you questions. And maybe you don't know your contracts very well. I think it's a great idea to keep track of your customer contracts, keep track of what the term, when they renew, if they have like an auto renew, keeping track of that so that they don't lapse and you don't realize it, and then you're not really operating under a contract. I think just staying organized with those types of documents, and also just like your internal organizational documents, like I mentioned before, make sure you're keeping track of who actually owns your company. And if there's a redemption or a transfer or an assignment of shares, making sure that that's documented. It's going to be a lot more expensive later on to go back and try to figure that out than it would be to just monitor everything as it's happening.
Back in my, before I started Focus, I was, worked for a public company. We actually did 17 acquisitions in 24 months, and that was my job. Now we had a, you've reminded me of the due diligence checklist. So if anybody wants to get really, make yourself sick, okay, ask your attorney to send you a due diligence checklist. It's about 80 pages, okay? And each page probably has 8 to 10 things that you're going to be asked for. And you're going to get through like the second page and you're just going to throw up. I mean, this, the things that, that you get asked for, this is by the buyer, is just an astronomical amount of things. So again, if you don't have that stuff, and this Anne's points are great. If you don't have that stuff, it's all going to get messy. And again, from a buyer, as somebody who's bought a lot of companies, I love to string deals out. I love to string them out. Because guess what? You get distracted. Your earnings start to fall. And the price is always going to go down. So time kills deals. Time kills your price. But if you're organized and have it up front, and you know what you're getting into, and you've got the good documents and everything, it can go really, really fast. And it can be a really positive experience. But the last thing I'll say, well, not going to be the last thing, but the other thing I'll say about this is you have to have the best corporate attorney you can get. Your friend down the street who does real estate as an attorney, you're going to get destroyed. Okay. You have to pay up. It doesn't matter what their rates are. You have to get a really, really good attorney that knows what they're doing to help you with this, or you'll pay for it and the price will go down. There's a plug for the good ball for us.
Well, we have a few minutes left. One last kind of quick rapid fire question. What's the one thing you want everybody to leave with before we open it up for a couple of questions?
I mean, I'm just going to emphasize what we talked about, like good books and records, being organized. I think that is absolutely key. And I know you're running a business, and the last thing you want to think about is all of this other stuff that isn't, you know, it's not affecting your day-to-day right now. It's off in the future that you might want to sell your company, but it's just going to make everything easier, and it's going to make you run more efficiently. And even if you just, you know, you want to expand, you don't necessarily want to sell, or you want to bring in investors, they're also going to want to do due diligence on your company. So I think you're just setting yourself up for success if you're running it efficiently day in and day out.
I would ask yourself a difficult question, and there's no wrong answer, but ask yourself, are you running a lifestyle business or a business for profit? And but there's nothing wrong with the answer, but you should know and be able to clearly define what that means, and make sure that we're all, in theory, trying to avoid taxes, but it's going to be a lot cleaner if you've paid tax and you can show profitability, and there isn't your books aren't as dirty as they should be for no reason. So,
the line I use is: all my friends who don't pay any taxes don't have any money, and all my friends who pay a lot of taxes have a lot of money. And it's funny, I call that growing up, because there's lots of ways that you can do your tax accounting, and there's lots of tax breaks that you get, and you could have a good tax return, good tax CPA, and I'm not knocking, I used to be a tax CPA, I'm not knocking it, but you pay your tax CPA to give you good tax advice, not to help you increase the value of your business. And so I think the comment that I'll make is, and piggyback on what was said, was, look, nobody can do this by themselves. Nobody. Nobody that is entrepreneurial can start a business and do all of these things themselves. You have to have people around you. Now, that requires us to be coachable. Okay. It's really hard. One of our core values is coachable. We want all of our associates to be coachable. I'm the one that kind of gets dinged down on that, because it's like, I always think I'm right. You have to surround yourself with people. Even before you need them, you have to have a really strong financial person. But I'm not talking about your CPA. You have to have a really good CPA. You have to have a really strong financial person. You have to have a really good attorney. You have to have business coaches, people that have been there. Maybe it's a personal advisor, somebody, but just there is nothing wrong with raising your hand and saying, I think I've kind of hit my limit. Now, one of the things that I preach over and over is this concept called, it's not my concept, it's Dan Sullivan's concept. It's called unique ability. And what is it that we're really good at? Nobody's really good at everything. The trick is to figure out what you're really good at and do it, and then get other people to do all the other things. But maybe you need EOS, maybe you need a business coach, maybe you need a fractional marketing person, maybe you need to upgrade your CPA or your attorney. Just take those steps before you need them. Somebody said in one of the other sessions about hiring employees based on where you're going. I think it was Ben. Based on where you're going, not based on where you are. It's the same thing with your advisors. Make sure you have advisors based on where you're going, not based on, and look, sometimes we have great friendships with the people who have been our attorney or our CPA or whatever. And we literally just, we outgrow our advisors just like we outgrow some of our employees. And that's okay. It's okay.
Everybody's just hungry or wanting coffee. Well, that's fine. We're still good. So nothing wrong with an early break. Appreciate everybody. Appreciate the panelists. Nope. Question. Snuck one in here.
What is that point where you decide to just grow your business or sell your business, which is, you know, like where we're at, I guess, you know, do you just continue growing or do you just.
I'll give my very quick, I was sharing this with Joran earlier. I had a conversation with one of the folks who was part, who was the main person behind the company that I was involved with. And I joke with Joran, I'm like, there's a number. Like, it wasn't our intent to sell, but there's a number.
Yeah.
So like, what's the number? And we had a great conversation over a lot of period of time as to what the minimum number was. But that was a really big catalyst. I think John mentioned, like, in terms of the vision for where you want to go, that point really was a catalytic moment, because from there on, it was like, okay, if we get into this ballpark, as from an enterprise value standpoint, we know our multiple is likely going to be this, which puts us kind of in this category of we're actually going to consider it. And I just joke with Jordan, is it a million? It's like, where's it at? What, 80 million? And then we toggled to actually where it was. That's just my perspective.
I can only speak to my personal experience, but when I was grow until I stopped having fun. And that's when I knew it was time to look in another direction. So,
yeah, I was going to say, I think you have to ask yourself, is this something I want to be doing forever? Or is there something else out there for me? And I've done what I can here and I'm interested in new opportunities. And I think it is a good discussion to have, like, what is the price? Because sometimes people will approach you without you having to go solicit, and a great opportunity could fall into your lap. So knowing, like, what that price is that you would be willing to sell, I think is a really good strategy.
Yeah, I love the comment about when you're not having fun anymore. So we talk a lot in our business model about having healthy companies. So having a healthy company should come before you try to grow, because if you grow and you're not healthy, then you just end up with a bigger unhealthy company. So I would always advise people to run your business to be really healthy, which means cash flow is really strong, systems work, the leadership team works. And you can have fun in that model because you're not bogged down completely. And you've also positioned yourself for a sale if it were to happen. So if you focus on the health aspect of it, I think you give yourself options. If you just try to grow, look, there's just nothing worse than growing. Look, it takes cash to grow. That's a problem. And then we all run out of cash. What do we do? And then we're all more stressed out. It's like, so it's focus on getting healthy and focus on cash flow and have fun. And if you get to the point that you've either hit your number or somebody you're just not having fun anymore, then at least you have options. But you really need to understand as part of that how valuation really works. I'll share with you. I talked to she's running a $1 million business, losing $200,000. And she's got 5 locations. And I'm like, Samantha, what do you want to do? I mean, she's out of money. What do you want to do? She says, I think I want to sell. I says, what do you think it's worth? And she said, 8. And I said, eight what? And she said, it's a true story. She said, $8 million. And I said, Samantha, your company's not worth $8. It's that gap between how does valuation really, really work? Because it's not 10 times revenue. Okay, it's 5 times profit, 7 times profit. I understand that.
Last question.
Was there any way, didn't you cover that? Is it influences that multiplier number that when things get assessed, and there are specifics that you really even pay attention to for that specifically?
I'll share not from a facilitator perspective, but with our company was actually on top of, as part of the diligence package, they actually had like an assessment tool for the technology. So it was like almost like run the technology. We want to see how it functions. And they had a whole bunch of indicators that said whether or not it actually was working and the strength. I think that's the only thing that I can think of that we haven't touched on as part of the diligence process and other ways that would increase value. Because if it comes back strong, there's no issues or there's very few issues, it's really smooth, efficient, you get a potentially higher multiple than if it's clunky, if it breaks, when you hit enter, it doesn't work.
This may or may not apply, but it to your business, but you have to have a reoccurring revenue model where it's consistent and reoccurring, and year over year you have the same customers, let's say, and they require your services again and again and again, or if it's repeatable. So,
buy this book, write this down. There's a book called 17 Reasons Your Company Is Not Investment Grade. Hmm. It's written by a guy named Zane Terrence. He's an investment banker out of Birmingham. It's dead on. If you walk with me to my car, I'll give you one. But the number one reason is lack of recurring revenue. But then it goes to systems, processes, leadership team, contracts, employment contracts, just use of technology, all those things. If you package all those things together and you can get those things going right, man, you got something to be really, something really special. 17 Reasons Your Company Is Not Investment Grade.
Who's the author?
Zane Terrence.
Thank you all, and thank you panelists for weighing in.
Latte for Keenan?
That's me.
Hey, you're...
Yeah.
Buying a car online on AutoTrader?
Really? But unlike other sites, you can start online, test drive with a local dealer, then finish online or at the dealership.
Really? Wait, are you...
Yep, it's key.
...able to finish in person without starting the process over?
Really? Your info stays with you every step of the way.
Cool. Enjoy.
It's Keenan Thompson. Buy your car online on AutoTrader. Really?